knowledge of my work to do the lecture for me. So there she is. She was fitted with an invisible earpiece and repeated things I prompted her. So in a way, she was the medium. So I gave her the message, but she had no prior knowledge. So for her, she was just the carrier of the message. So it's a distinction between medium and message. She's an actress, very brave also, I think. And her performance, as you can imagine, was quite robotic because she had to listen to what I said and repeat it immediately, but it took some time. So this is a moment where she is listening. So here we go to the next level. Now, at one point, and I will show you later, she was showing a piece that I did in 1995, quite some time ago, where I play a guest role in a Lithuanian soap series. I play a guest role as a Dutch artist visiting Lithuania. She showed an excerpt from that soap, from the one episode, and people could immediately see that I don't look like her. And that was supposed to be the moment where the audience would say, hey, something is wrong. Now, what you see depends on what you're looking for. Because what happened was that people looked and they said, why? She has changed. So the fact that I'm standing here and you're sitting there somehow gives me an authority that you think I am Barbara Visser because I'm announced like that, but you don't know that. Of course, maybe it doesn't matter. But here, as an experiment, I think it was very interesting because I really thought people would, you know, see it and be aware that something was going on, but they didn't. So this was quite strange. There were many questions from the audience asking her if she had practiced with an actor for the lecture or if she was very nervous. And then she was waiting because I had to think of an answer, give it to her, and she repeated. So she looked, in a way, it was a retarded performance. Literally retarded. But an audience is very patient, it turns out. Okay, so 1997. In 2004, the Berlin Biennial asked me to repeat the experiment. And I said, I have no intention to repeat it because I know what will happen. But I will make the next version of this work. So I asked the casting agent to cast an actress that looked like me to tell about this project in more or less the manner that I'm telling you now. So this is how that looked. So Jolien, the blonde actress, is in the back. And then Saskia, she explained what was going on and how the audience bought it and what happened. Now there was a situation that the audience thought it was me pretending to be an actress. So a very complicated set of things. But this actress was also fitted with an earpiece, and also she had any knowledge. Then I was asked to do it a third time, and I thought, this has to end. This has to end somewhere. So let me see. They're a bit... Okay, so here's a connection. So that was the last, I call it last lecture. And I did a performance where I placed myself behind the screen and did a voiceover for the two actresses. So I made a kind of a full circle, so I never had to do it again. I'm showing you this because I think especially for my earlier works, the idea of identity and stepping out of yourself and being someone else or being replaced by someone is a very common theme. Here is the audience asking a question. You see also the look of it is very 90s, very old video. So she gets the question, is this just the way you always behave? Of course, as an artist, you can get away with murder. So. And then she asked, do I appear to be myself to you? I'm talking way too long about this. And then the moderator got fed up and he thought, why don't they see it? Why don't they see it? And he said, and the real Barbara Visser, and I didn't want it to be revealed. So I didn't say anything and people went home puzzled, rather puzzled. So I saw that I mixed something up. Because there was a still from this Lithuanian soap series that she showed. So that is me married to a doctor, a Lithuanian doctor. Very young picture. Here also. This also, I thought very interesting to go into a fictional situation that represented the reality of Lithuania at the time. Playing a Dutch artist in Lithuania for a show, which was actually what was going on. And here I'm interviewed by an art program for television, which was then included in the soap series. So, as you can see, it's always a hall of mirrors. Now, for me, it was quite enough to be on a soap series in that country because it was very popular. But back in the Netherlands, people asked, could we see some of that, you know? And I said, well, it's very bad. I have to speak Lithuanian and you don't want to see that. But they said, yeah, but it's conceptual. Conceptually, it's interesting. And how do you then present something literally made for an audience that is not aware that they're looking at art, and then suddenly transpone it to the gallery space. Very difficult. In a way, I'm always very keen to make invisible art, to make art that no one notices that it's actually art. So here I made a schedule of who is related to who in what way. With a making of video, and my biggest claim to fame was becoming a calendar girl on the calendar of the series. Newspaper article. So this is the 1996 calendar, the December plate. No feet, but other than that. But of course, this is a side street, but if you make very site-specific work, you're the gallerist's nightmare because there's never anything to sell, you know? It's not a commodity in that sense. So now I told you I was going in a non-chronological way. I'm going to briefly, very briefly, talk about my childhood. And in very large steps. So I grew up in Amsterdam in the 1960s and 70s. My parents were hippies, we could say. I don't know if there's an English word for it, but they said that they now say we wanted to give you a free upbringing, you know, with no boundaries and no rules and no, which in a way it was very difficult, very difficult. Took me many years of therapy to get over that. No structure, no rules, nothing. Very lonely also. And they, my parents had many books on how to live. They wanted ways, they didn't want to do it like their parents, they, you know, the Second World War, Jewish. So they needed books to find out, to have manuals on how to operate in the world, how to become happy, maybe even. So these type of titles were, of course, probably you know them, filled the bookshelves. And I was very interested in these books. And, of course, later when I was treated myself for this terrible childhood, I got fascinated by this literature again, and how this also shaped the way my parents behaved. But these are more American and very hands-on, so they're not all related to Freud, of course. I come from a tradition of the talking cure, talking, talking, talking. But then there's these popular books that go into no doing, doing, no talking, no thinking, doing. Only looking forward, not backwards. As awful as they are, they're also fantastic. And this is one of my favorites too. Now, of course, I hear you laugh, so it's recognition, I think. This can get also out of hand if it's too taking too literally. Read this book and start winning today. Strictly speaking, this is not a self-help book. This is more, I make a distinction between the psychology books and the more professional literature. This is on the edge. So this is in a very short time span. This is my childhood. And I wanted to show you three videos. I'm not sure if we can show them entirely, because it's also very warm here. Not a lot of oxygen. That's the Freud Museum way. It's kind of a womb situation. We can open something.
Yeah, you have 20 minutes now.
Yeah.
So 10 minutes
from showing. 10?
Is that okay?
Then I'll show excerpts. Okay, and we can also vote on what to show longer. Well, let me see. There's one book that I tried to make a film of, and that's called Stop Thinking, Start Living. Also about doing and not dwelling on things. What I did, I'm just going to start a video. I need to. So I have asked.
Try to forget about all the attempts you have.
So we need.
try to forget about all the attempts you have.
Yeah.
See whether it makes sense to you, and if it sounds like something that already... Excuse me. Try to forget.
I never know whether to explain before or after.
After.
Okay, I'll just show it to you. Oh, no, halfway, perhaps.
It's about
halfway.
All the attempts you have. See whether it makes sense to you, and if it sounds like something that already... Excuse me. Some of what I propose will be quite different from what you have been exposed to before. Some of what I propose will be quite different from what... I am a stress management consultant. People learn about the habitual processes that contribute to their own misery and the ways that they use their own minds to sabotage. They quickly discover a natural and relatively effortlessly... My approach is based on a simple set of principles known as the psychology. My approach is based on a set of principles that there most certainly are. There most certainly are. One of the consistent problems I've seen in working with clients who have given up on... There are always new sessions designed to get to the bottom of each additional issue. Each specific issue, they will be miserable forever. They will be miserable forever. The therapists who tell you, nevertheless, is getting in touch with more negative. Does this mean that therapy is useless? No. I would say, however, it should not, however, be used in lieu of professional treatment, suicidal urges, or other serious mental... I have never met a person who didn't feel better once you learn how to stop his pattern. And indeed, he never does. But instead is seen suddenly, as if out of nowhere. I had spent my entire life frightened. Sudden shifts are accompanied by a feeling of inspiration, not through a chance, not through a change in circumstance. If you do, your experience of life will change before your eyes, as you think. So, as you think, so shall. Without commitment, success is any event. Success in any venture is difficult, whether you are dieting. Most of us believe that by solving our problems, we will find. Thinking works the same way. The result of this thought would be that you would be feeling skeptical. The result of this thought would be that you would be feeling. The result of this. Now suppose that you were reading the morning paper. If you had thought differently, I'm not saying that there are never physiological components that compound. But some people see they are real thoughts. It was real once, but not any longer, thereby making that event even seem... To make matters worse, your mind can add additional drama to that. Would you have her come to your home weekly? A gentleman came into my stress management office. His thoughts, his feelings, came from his job and from...
Let's stop at the stretch mark. So, quick explanation. I had the book Stop Living read by an actor. And I said only the glitches in his reading. I made an edit of his mistakes in the reading. And then I had it. I had the subtitles made also by a speech recognition program. So suicidal urges become bicycle owners. This was also to look at how this program that has really no emotion creates text that when you read it is
suddenly humorous or very sad or so this goes on for a while. It was a kind of play, trying to find out how things work and how this, you know, how you could use a book like that as the source for a work. I will show a short excerpt from a work that is not about Madame B, but is about client 8035, I think. And that client, oh, this is the wrong movie. I was invited to make a self-portrait for an exhibition in London, actually. And the self-portrait is a classical theme in art, of course. And although I'm always very interested in the idea of identity, a real self-portrait, an honest self-portrait, if such a thing exists, I'd never really done that. So what I did was I asked the Psychoanalytical Institute in the Netherlands for my file that had, I assumed, had built up over the years. And after quite a while, after a month or two, and paying €27.50, I got my file. Shockingly, there was part of a file of someone else in that file, because I don't remember having committed a murder. But most of it was about me. And again, it's perhaps as a self-portrait, it's questionable. But I found it interesting that someone else who was very interested in my psyche had written a text about me.
Every day begins in the same way. Barbara. Barbara.
Sorry, I have to clarify. There are introductions and chapter intervals written by a novelist. So this is the novelist part, but you will know immediately when it's from the file. Also, on the screen, you see excerpts of works that deal with my either my appearance or my identity.
On the first line of the first page of the first book, see how it marches. Barbara. See how it moves. Steady and sure, clean and smooth, across the blank white expanse. See how it gestures at the distance beyond. Every day begins in the same way because it helps to get something down on paper. Markings, symbols, a word, an identity. The idea of a person.
So you see a video work from 1994, part of it.
Client ID 8034. 1. This person appears to lack a consistent and well-defined coping style. Instead, she goes back and forth between expressive and ideational ways of dealing with her experience, often ineffectively and without a clear sense of purpose. Such people tend to have difficulty making decisions because they vacillate between paying attention to their mind and paying attention to their feelings. 2. This person appears to be in a state of mild but chronic stimulus overload, resulting from persistent difficulty in mustering adequate psychological resources to cope with the demands being imposed on her by internal and external events in her life. This finding is not surprising in light of other indications that her adaptive capacities are below average for an adult. Therefore, she is likely to have difficulty managing even ordinary ideational and emotional stresses of everyday life without becoming unduly upset by them. She's consequently at risk of recurring episodes of overt anxiety, tension, nervousness, and irritability. People with this pattern of stimulus overload tend to have limited tolerance for frustration and less than average ability to persevere in the face of obstacles. They may constantly show a tendency towards emotional outbursts and impulsive actions. Every story begins in the same way, with not knowing, with waiting to find out, conducting experiments and trials, incarnations of incarnations, in the hope that we might get to the soft bit at the center, that we may be afforded access. This person often attempts to deal with uncertainty about her image of herself and or concerns about her self-value in an overly intellectualized manner that may distort or overlook realistic considerations. Individuals who intellectualize in this way often have difficulty exercising adequate control over their own thoughts and are vulnerable to developing inaccurate images of themselves. A portrait, a sitting, a moment in time, individual, an individual, proliferate, paper thin, carbon copies and copies of copies. It is like printing money. Through a series of displacements, hands upon hands, images, renderings are everywhere, simultaneously filled with and emptied of value as their flourishing dismembers the codes and currencies of possession. Possession, so intimately related to identity. Ten. This person shows little interest in or expectation of engaging in collaborative or competitive relationships with other people. Because of her seeming indifference or aversion to interpersonal involvement, she's likely to strike others as distant and aloof. Although she may not be actively disliked by members of social groups to which she belongs, she has limited prospects of becoming socially popular or well-liked. Her personality characteristics in this regard will not necessarily prevent her from forming close relationships on an individual basis, but they are likely to result in her often hovering on the periphery of group interactions rather than seeking or finding a place at their core.
I think because it's almost time, I have one more excerpt from a continuation of this. This goes
on for quite a while. It's about half an hour. Now, where to go from here? Looking at the idea coming from those self-help books through a kind of self-portrait, I was wondering where to go from here. And I visited the psychology department of the University of Barcelona, the Event Lab, and they are doing experiments with virtual reality.
Do you think we will ever know who?
And what? There, well, perhaps it's being explained here. I think the professor is explaining it quite well. But in virtual reality, they do experiments with how you can have an experience as if you were in the body of someone else, talking to yourself. It's a little bit like the Gestalt, where you have two chairs opposite each other. However, they have, in the one body, you are yourself, and in the other body, you are Freud. And that's what they, this experiment, I did it as a test.
Do you think we will ever know who we are ourselves?
It's not clear exactly what that would mean. How would we know if we knew who we were? I think you're right that the perspective taking is one critical aspect of it, because I mean, perspective taken in a very broad sense, in a specific sense and a broad sense. The specific sense is I'm literally outside of my body. I'm taking another perspective on my body and that body explaining a problem. The second aspect of perspective taking is that while my body is explaining the problem, I'm someone else. And often in real life, you're much better at solving other people's problems than you are your own, because when you're you, you're stuck in your normal ways of thinking about things. And it's very hard often to break out of that. Even though you're the person who knows most about you, you think about you in a very standard, normal way that you always have. It's very difficult to see things objectively. But when you're outside of you, that distance somehow creates a different perspective. And the third aspect of our particular experiment was not only are you in a different body, and you're in a different place observing yourself describing a problem, but the body you're in is reminiscent of someone who's supposed to be good at problem solving, which was Freud, I mean, counseling.
Yeah.
So the real interesting thing in this experiment for me, one of the reasons I did it, was to see if you're counseling yourself in a Freud body compared with counseling yourself in another copy of your own body, do you do better when you're in the Freud body? And we tested that, and the answer seemed to be yes. So somehow you draw on resources, you kind of enhance your own cognitive abilities by somehow, we don't know how it works, drawing on the fact that the body you're in is supposed to be wise in dealing with personal problems.
I'll just step into it, you know, I'll just go right into it. I won't talk about my childhood. I'm going to confront you with something that's in my psychoanalytical file, and perhaps you can reflect on it. It says somewhere in the middle that I am using intellectualization as a defense mechanism. I don't know if this is a known condition, and if you have any thoughts on that, perhaps what I could do about it, or whether that's a good thing or a bad thing. As it is in my file, I think it suggests that it's a bad thing.
So I'd like to hear your thoughts on it.
Okay, Barbara, what I hear is that you are not sure about the status of this condition or this trait that you seem to have?
I don't know if you're ashamed of being an intellectual or trying to be an intellectual. It might be that you're trying to avoid feeling things by staying into the realm of the intellect and trying to rationalize your way out of specific issues.
This is something many people do, especially people who are highly educated. But even if they're highly educated, that doesn't mean that they know more about how to handle feelings than people with lesser education. So I can imagine that this is this could become problematic for you.
So, shall we stop here?
Questions.
Okay.
Well today, so that's good. I'm sure the last session went as well.
Can I ask a question?
Yes.
I was interested to know what you thought of what you've seen.
What you presented?
Yeah.
First of all, I think we certainly don't know what we thought of what you presented. I mean, from each other.
No.
Yeah. So, yeah, we're unique in that sense.
That's true. Well, let's start with you then.
What did I think?
Could I ask a question to you, to Denis and Diana? It may seem like a non sequitur, but I was curious, what about art, given the context of the rest of the day, like where you see an artistic practice or, I don't want to use the word creativity, but what you, I love the presentation. I felt like it, as if I were in a kind of chamber where I could think and see at the same time. It was really great, but I'm also curious, given the context of the day, where you would, if you could talk about that.
Thank you. Yeah, I think it's an interesting question also related to your question, Barbara, because it's, and to what Emma said also at the beginning, and the question of the dream Joe mentioned as well, is it's always about what we hear. And you mentioned that very well with the audience you had. Those people definitely wanted to hold, to control in a way who you might be, who they had in front of them. And relating to our work, I think it's the opposite.
Mm-hmm.
It's completely the opposite in a way, because I think it's more a question of not controlling or not understanding. I don't think we expect the people who come to the practice room, and the two cases we presented were not patient in the sense that they had not started a therapy, a psychotherapy. They were in that psychiatry unit. But should they have, I think it's quite unlikely that they would have started anything with anyone in the room. So they would have to start all over again and be someone else at that time. And at each session, you're someone else in a way.
Denny, I have a question for you and Diana as well. First a clarification, because I had assumed that they were already in analysis, the patient, and they were taken out to do this. So is the person who does the presentation, the psychoanalyst who does that bit of it, do they end up becoming the person's psychotherapist? Okay, so.
No, it's definitely one-off.
Okay.
And it's only interesting in those 50 minutes what you can hear from what they say.
Okay.
Each of them. And in that sense, to answer Vanini's question about art, I think it might have some relation as a one-off performance, because the audience is also making something out of... that's where I thought it was very good to have you before or after us. I mean, at the same time, in that sense of having an audience, and the audience is actually making the art, in a way, always making the performance as such.
Well, you also mentioned that one of the patients looked at the audience while speaking, as almost as giving a performance, being aware of the performative nature of her.
We sort of decided that she might have the idea that she would gain her freedom out of this performance she was doing.
If she turned in a good enough performance, whatever that might have meant.
Performing sane. Performing to be sane.
Yeah. To be seen. Mm. Yeah,
to
exactly.
To be sane. Exactly. Yeah.
And I just have a rejoinder for that, which was my question. I found it totally fascinating to hear the talk, and like Vanaline felt that I was in the moment and could see the situation as well as hear the situation. But I was really concerned about the ethics of the situation. And so you have that normal, you know, the normative structure is one-on-one, and then you have the critique of the normative structure with Guattari, for instance, looking at the group. So then you have a group of analysands and one analyst, and so the power dynamic of that is very particular. And now you have a group of psychotherapists and one patient, so it feels really problematic to me to have that, because the power dynamic is so the opposite of what it should be, or different from how it should be. And I'm wondering what your experience of that is in participating in it, and what you think of it in terms of psycho, in terms of training. So I'm just curious.
This is something that troubled us from the beginning to the end, and particularly because the Madame Bay was actually the first patient that we saw, and so there was this question very prominently of what was it for her? What did she understand was sort of being asked of her, and what did she think might be available to her in consequence of agreeing to be part of it? So, you know, it was a very troubling beginning in a way. So I guess I want to say about it that it remains a very, it remains in question for me. It certainly is the case that because of the ethical concerns, it would not be possible to do that, I think, except in very particular circumstances in this country, where you would have to fly under the radar of institutional requirements around who can be present and who not, and contracts and so on, would be extremely difficult to do, I think, in this country, and isn't generally done. Whereas in France, it's considered absolutely central alongside of a person's own analysis to the process of training. And I must say that as a person experienced in psychoanalytic training, I learned far more from these monthly encounters, I feel, than I've learned from any number of seminars or clinical presentations which are done as kind of third person presentations in this country. So it's a very complex and difficult space. From a Lacanian perspective, there is something to be said about what it is for a psychotic patient to have an audience, that there is, they would argue, I think, that there may indeed be something quite, if not exactly therapeutic, something quite sustaining for patients to be in the position of being attended to precisely by an audience. So it's a very complex matter.
Okay, we've got
Yes, also.
I just want to just pencil something now, maybe for discussion later, about the attention paid to art and the attention paid to the patient in the sessions which the two of you just talked about, and about, I suppose, what lies at maybe the heart of our discussions here in the work of the Freud Museum in exhibitions, and the way Joanna developed her talk today, and also in everything we've seen. And I'm kind of, I just want to pencil in something about how interesting it is to think about how little one can say about art, just as in the sense of when we hear your story of listening to that patient, you say nothing, but you report a hearing of signifiers. And if we as art thinkers or art critics or art writers were to also to fragment our own process into one of the reception of signifiers and their reorganization, we would do much less as if it were psychoanalytic interpretation of the artwork than we currently do. So I'm kind of interested in a way in relation to this about how little we as people who attend to art can say about it and still correlate new information or whatever you want to call it out of the reorganization of the way we observe those signifiers. That would be one way of bringing art, thinking art, writing into relationship with psychoanalysis without saying it is in any way like it or has any relationship to it. Or it's a non-relation, I would say. I'd like to restart there perhaps later on.
Thank you. Hi. I found your talk so fascinating. I don't really have a question, but I have an observation that's mixed up with a question to you both. And as both an artist and an occasional psychiatric patient, I remember being psychotic, a time when I was psychotic, and imagining that I was in the hospital, but I was acting in a kind of script that was contained in my file that was making, I was acting the part of someone being psychotic. So the scenario that you give of the patient almost being part of a spectacle and part of a play that you would watch as, you know, in your training, as a sometime patient, I find it kind of abhorrent. But as an artist, I find it utterly fascinating, and especially linking it in with Barbara's practice. And is there, are there any kind of questioning in France about the ethics of it? Is there anybody within institutions or practice that is questioning the ethics?
Oh, yeah, there's very savage critiques go on in France as well by people who've been involved in this training, who come to precisely to a sort of Foucauldian view about power dynamics of the situation that that they come to find untenable. But it seems to me that around this question of what is the relation between these things, that there is something, your point taken also, Adrian, about there being no relation in a certain way. There is something in both domains, I think, about this matter of the staging of the unconscious, which, however you might want to think about it, is something of what you're doing, I think, in the work that you showed, Emma, and something of what you're doing as well, Barbara, and is often something of what one sees in art, in the work of Louise Bourgeois and whoever else. And on the other hand, although that's right, that the psychoanalytic situation is a situation between two in a room, there has always been something about the transmission or the reporting or the speaking about or the something of what happens in that room that is part of the psychoanalytic tradition, so that, you know, Freud's cases are everybody knows everything about those people, who they are and what they're like, beyond what went on in the room. And, of course, that is not replicated, but there is a way that something of it is replicated in that something goes on between two people in a room, and then some of that material is reported to a supervisor, and then some of that material is presented in clinical seminars as part of the transmission of the discipline. And so there is a way that this staging that is seen in a kind of relief in this hospital setting is something of what goes on in the way that psychoanalysis is learned and practiced. And of course, the reading of art by Freud and by Lacan has been, of art and writing and so on, has been also a very important element of their theorizing, actually, the evolution of their theory. So it seems to me that in these various ways, through these, through that tradition and that evolution, and the way that these talks today somehow are interweaving and speaking to one another without at the same time being of the same thing, that there is something very important to be thought about the relation between these apparently very different places.
And if I can add, because I think what you said was I think is triggering immediately question about who we are, who's the mad in that sense, which chair we're in, and which has also been brought by the different people today, is the idea of the file. Mm-hmm. I think it's fair to say that in psychoanalytic tradition, there's no file. There's the construction of a case for a very specific purpose, which is transmission. This is that kind of structure, and you can recognize that by those sort of sign, let's say. But the person who actually was the base of that case somehow vanishes from the case itself. But then they exist nonetheless. So it's always, and then we get back to the layers and to where you are and to your parents, in a way, wanting to go away from that, and you wanted to go back to a certain kind of structure, knowing who you were.
But it's strange. To me, it was helpful that I was never referred to as a person, but always as a number. On the other hand, I saw this file as a fictional account of a person, maybe also to protect myself, I don't know. But I saw it as a story that someone had written on the basis of a number of interactions. And to my great surprise, part of it was written in English. And I have never spoken to anyone in English or have been replied to in English. And I don't know why that is. One of the things that maybe not for this discussion that I'm very interested in is that I refused to do a Rorschach test. I guess everyone knows what that is here. But I thought, as an artist, I cannot do that. Mm-hmm. And they freaked out by that. And I later read in the file that people who react to a Rorschach test like that have high risk of suicide. Mm. Mm. I didn't know that. But I tried to discuss why, as an artist, I was biased to do that test. But I felt like I got in. You know, they saw that as pathology, and there it was very strange mix of me trying to explain something and they say interpreting it, that as a pathological, very, very scary and interesting as well.
Okay, so we have Griselda. There's somebody here. Oh, yeah. Okay. I don't think I've ever any said anything in under 15 minutes, so I can't remember myself.
Here.
Back again.
This is for you.
That's right. That's what it is. Francisco kept flashing this to me. Okay, thank you very much. I wanted to pick up three things from this morning. One is, there seems to me three different things going on. One is, we talked earlier this morning about the question of art therapy, which seems to me modeled on a certain notion of 19th century art and romantic expressionism, the self expresses themselves. That's one thing. Secondly, when Freud was trying to talk about art, he's also a 19th century person. He didn't understand what had happened in the shift. And one of the things he said, which is, you know, that the artist had already known most of the processes that psychoanalysis would give a name to, but the problem was they didn't know themselves, their own unconscious, when it worked through the process. So there's something where he's talking about the novelist. He's saying it's not the symptoms or the patterns or the stories, it's the repetition. It's the thing that keeps happening, that unresolvable thing that causes the artist to make art over and over again. And that's what I've always been very fascinated in, why no artwork does it, right? So there's no point at which you touch what it is, which is why you keep doing it. But it has to be unknown to the subject. So I thought the kind of turning around where you are forced in the virtual situation to imagine yourself speaking, but it also was so profoundly shocking, and I think it is a problem with the psychoanalytical community, which I think Joanne has brought up just very briefly ethically, which is the manner in which another discourse can be had about you in your absence between a highly professionalized group of people who, what you revealed, who speak from very specific positions. Now, constantly suggest this person over-intellectualized, I am 100% sure that is gendered, right? Women over-intellectualized because they're meant to be thus, etc. Fantastic, intelligent, lively, brilliant, energetic, you know, woman full of, in fact, absolutely capacity to be both insightful and infectious, and the manner in which you do it is presented as someone who somehow is trying to control something that shouldn't be controlling things. So I just feel we have to be much more careful of the ideologies which the psychoanalytical traditions themselves perform, reenact, because they are institutions. And one of the great things about the Lacanian is Lacan, as he realized he was about to kill by virtue of the problem of institutionalization. And so I think the conversation between artists and psychoanalysts is not using the institutional discourse to analyze art, but using art, in a sense, to analyze the institutionalization.
Actually, you partly answered what I wanted to ask you about, but I was fascinated with the film that you have made. And I just can't help asking you, what was it like for you to read a statement that you are using intellectualization as a defense mechanism, and immediately the writer of those words is going into generalization. People who blah, 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 then do this. So we could see that the writer is giving a portrait of someone who is using defense mechanism, you who invested your time in search for your identity or whatever, and then goes somewhere which I understood as a fear of language. The person is using rhetoric from the point of where he perceives himself in a position to judge someone else. I wonder, I was just somehow expecting your anger, and I wondered what was the function of this moment for your psychoanalysis, the process of analysis, and what was the function of that moment and your search for that document in your artistic process, whether and how these two meet and what emotions do they produce?
Well, that's a big question. Well, first of all, reading that, trying to read it as fiction and trying to stay at a distance is already a form of, well, intellectualizing, I think, is creating the distance from yourself and the text. What this text told me was that, first of all, I am not unique. You can put labels on many of my characteristics that I think, well, that's just my character, suddenly is a pathological label. And I think I tried to not become emotional about that file. It didn't happen because I saw it as a subjective view by someone else, and I did recognize a lot of things. On the other hand, it wasn't news.
Yeah,
then we're back to virtual presentation.
Sorry, did you have a question? Final question. We'll have Q&A right at the end as well. So final.
Hello, thank you. It has been really interesting listening to everyone speak today, actually. But I just wanted to kind of, going back to what you were saying earlier about the kind of performative nature of this space within an institution, I mean, I really couldn't help but drawing the parallels between, you know, your fine art practice and this kind of psychoanalytical kind of process that was coming on for kind of assessment. It feels like there are some kind of distinct connections. And although, you know, you guys have said that, and it says in the text that it's not a performance and it is distinctly not anything to do with a fine art practice. This is a purely psychoanalytical kind of setting, professional, you know. But there are some real parallels in terms of this idea of, like, the unconscious emerging through a language and a narrative and a dialogue and kind of that orchestration that's happening within these performative spaces, whether that is in a gallery setting or in an institution. I'm just wondering if we could just talk quickly about where we would draw the line between kind of that performativity that I think we all kind of find is kind of soaks into the normative in our day-to-day lives. Because, I mean, there was some real kind of points where I would say that it was the performativity and even the role of the, you know, the spectator and the audience and, you know, putting people on a platform and the self-conversating, it's, you know, there's a lot of parallels here that I think do relate to a fine art context, even if in the institution that was not necessarily its initial intention. I mean, I, you know, working from my fine art practice, I found that space that you presented to us in the conversations incredibly performative, even, you know, in the nature of the woman trying to convince, you know, to gain freedom or, you know, so just wondering if we could maybe speak a little bit about the nature of performativity in that way.
So one immediate response that I have is that, of course, there's a certain way that what we have done today has definitely been performative in a way that I would say that what we witnessed was not. So, and of course, you know, there have been ethical questions for us about what we bring here and how we bring it and what we say about it and how we be respectful of the material, as it's called. But on the other hand, here we are wanting to convey something of what this rather remarkable experience has been, because it seems to say something beyond itself. So already there's questions about the sort of the site, I suppose, and the purpose that say something about the way in which something might be considered to be performative. The other thing I want to say is that there's something that perhaps didn't quite emerge from what we said, which is that so the patient comes into the room, there is this dialogue between the patient and the analyst. The patient leaves the room, and then in a certain way, the next part of what happens is just as important, I would say. So there has been a dialogue, of course, without that nothing happens. But then what goes on is something about how this group of people, each one, has heard what has been said. And so that you know, that's not on the side of the performative, but I suppose it is on the side of being the audience to something that has been staged. So,
and
I think we should draw the morning to a halt, although it's been fascinating, and thanks to all the speakers here. We have, as you see, run over a little bit, but the afternoon session is due to start at 2:45. Let's try and start it then, otherwise we'll be running later. But do enjoy your lunch.